This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe
on ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania.
G'day, welcome to the Country Hour. Coming up today, a campaign launched to overhaul biosecurity in Australia, including a new funding model to combat pests and diseases.
Act early, a stitch in time saves nine, and that's why this Protect Australia campaign we've just launched this week, calling for a bolstering of biosecurity in Australia to stop the things arriving in the first place. It's going to mean big wins, and we're not going to have new pests taking over Australia. We've already got enough problems as we already got.
And a warning, the price of some vegetables on the increase and shortages predicted after damaging rainfalls in Queensland.
Yeah, well, it's not only tomatoes, capsicums, corn, beans, all that sort of stuff's coming from up there now. Cherry tomatoes, yeah. Sweet potatoes is the main thing. They've went up 400% in the last 6 days.
Not a very nice price increase if you're a fan of sweet potatoes. That story coming up later in the program. But first to biosecurity. And the Invasive Species Council has launched a campaign to try and overhaul biosecurity in Australia, which it describes as environmentally weak. Chief Executive of the Council, Andrew Cox, says the move follows a report on biosecurity, which contains 42 recommendations to improve the fight against pests. Andrew Cox says at least their campaign called Protect Australia looks at new ways of funding biosecurity projects.
Well, there's a big shake-up. There's a major report brought down by an independent review panel headed up by Wendy Craik. It delivered its findings to all of the state and federal governments, and the ministers are going to come together at the end of the year to work out how to respond, whether to embrace all of the recommendations. 42 recommendations. It includes new funding, which is going to be a big gap filler for the weakened biosecurity system that we've had for environmental biosecurity, even marine biosecurity, some of the biosecurity that's going to stop things like fire ants keeping coming in. The government had a whole lot of money coming announced for the agriculture white paper, but that money will run out. So we need increasing container levies and things like that that will fund biosecurity properly. As our trade grows, the risk grows. So we just need to just put more resources into it.
What's this program called?
Well, we're calling it Protect Australia because we need strong biosecurity defences to still let trade in, but make sure it's clean, to make sure that the quarantine arrangements are good, but we're also on the lookout through good surveillance for new bugs that arrive, and we've got the responses ready to go. We've found, particularly with environmental biosecurity, that we're poorly prepared, and we've got lots of constant new arrivals. For example, there's no one in charge of environmental biosecurity at the moment. No one's actually responsible like they are for the next foot of mouth. We've got a chief, an animal health officer, a chief vet. We've got a plant protection officer. We've got a chief health officer for public diseases, but we don't have one for the environment. So that's having someone in charge is really important, and restructuring so that we make sure that at least we're giving the same amount of attention to environmental and community threats as we are giving already to agricultural threats.
Now you talk about funding there, new funding model. What sort of model is that? Is it user pays?
Well, the model's based on the principle that the risk creators, the thing that's exposing us to these new bugs and pests and diseases coming in the country, should be the ones who bear some of the burden. So a charge, a levy on containers coming into the country, a $10 increase to the levy, and also for air freight to make sure that those two major sources of the risk are putting forward the bill. It's only a small amount, but it actually will make a big difference.
So will farmers have to dip in?
Well, this is a good question because that's at the national level. The review also recommended at the state level. Some states have a levy based on properties up to 10 hectares, or 10 hectares and larger. They have to pay a levy, and they're recommending it should go down to about 2 hectares. So that even the small blockies that often are one of the sources of risks of poor land management and poor awareness about biosecurity risk, they need to be funding the system too. So each state's got to make those decisions. Tasmania's got its own arrangements, but at the moment they don't fully fund, the landowners aren't fully funding the biosecurity system. So that's something that the Tasmanian government and other state governments around Australia are going to need to look closely at as well.
And this biosecurity plan is going to be very, very important because the National Farmers Federation are saying that the level of agriculture, they want it to grow from $60 billion a year to $100 billion a year. But if you grow that, and eventually get to that area, obviously biosecurity is the threat's going to be bigger and bigger, isn't it?
Well, I guess they've got more at stake as the industry grows. Having new diseases arrive is going to be a bigger risk for them. So we've got to make sure that the defences are bolstered in light of this new trade. I mean, obviously that trade is going to be exports, and Australia is relying on its clean green image for its agriculture exports. But at the same time, we want to make sure the incoming goods are basically as clean as possible, that they're not carrying bugs accidentally. People aren't illegally bringing things in, so we're going to make sure the compliance is strong. And we've got to make sure we, even the basic things of understanding what risks we're exposed to for the environment, we haven't even identified the priority risks. We know things like fire ants are a big problem. There's a thing called the Asian black spine toad, which comes in from Southeast Asia. It's the cold climate version of the cane toad. We're watching out for that, but we haven't done a systematic look at all the other insect and pests that could come to Australia. So that's,
saying
this new reform that's in the wings.
You're saying that there's a cold climate cane toad, which could be in the southern states, the Victorias, the South Australias.
I don't think Victoria and Tasmania should relax about the cane toad. It might stop somewhere north of Sydney and north of Perth, but if the Asian black spine toad gets in, and it's actually been detected outside of our ports twice already in the last few years in Melbourne and Sydney. So, it's got a poisonous skin. It looks just like the cane toad, just a little bit smaller.
Now, we're talking to you, Andrew Cox, at the National Private Land Conservation Conference in Hobart, and it's brought together people from around the country and from around the world to talk about these sorts of things, and biosecurity is a big issue. And your presentation, I'll say Crazy Ants and Feral Deer, two influential landowner-led initiatives. Give us a rundown of your presentation, what you're talking about.
Well, what I think people around Australia are realising, invasive species are the big threat to conservation values. They're a threat to agricultural production. They're the big extinction driver, along with climate change and habitat transformation. And what we found is the community across Australia is stepping up in really interesting ways. So, for example, in Queensland, there's small outbreaks of yellow crazy ant. This is an ant a little bit different from the fire ant. It doesn't sting, but it sprays acid. And it's a real major threat to the tropical areas, the rainforests and the ground nesting birds and things. I guess what we've seen is in really different ways, the community is mobilizing. They've managed through a cane farmer called Frank Teodo and with the support of industry, tourism reps, community reps, have managed to convince government they need to spend over $10 million to eradicate the crazy ants around the Cairns area, the community at Karanda just nearby. They've just, on their own, done their own surveys of where the crazy ants are, and they're doing their own baiting of a 30-hectare area around Townsville, same thing. They're just saying, look, we're not going to tolerate the government stepping back from this. Let's nip it in the bud while it's a small area.
Where did these ants come from?
Yellow crazy ants from Africa and Asia.
Do we know how?
They came in probably from timber imports, accidentally stowaways. And because our quarantine wasn't good enough at those arrival points, they just slowly spread. We weren't even looking out for them. And there was a control program in place until 2012. The Queensland government axed it, and it was left to the community to solve the problem. And they're stepping up, and there's a really good model there, Karanda, the Karanda Envirocare, the Cairns community, and Townsville and Brisbane now. The councils are actually playing a really strong role too in providing the leadership and the funds when the state government and the federal government abandons those programs.
So extinction is the go. That's what's wanted.
They want to eradicate. We want to annihilate them from Queensland. Unfortunately, yellow crazy ants have already taken over Christmas Island, and it's going to be hard to eradicate them. And there's another population in Arnhem Land, but otherwise, that's the only place they're in Australia. So we want to eradicate the ants from Australia, so that they don't make our local native animals extinct.
And Andrew Cox, CEO of the Invasive Species Council. You did mention deer. You were heading into the deer. Dear to our heart here in Tasmania, and I know in other states, New South Wales, a big problem too, everywhere.
Well, a deer to people's hearts in different ways, and certainly some people love to shoot them, but they're here to stay. And in Southeast Australia, New South Wales, Victoria, Tasmania, they're taking up large proportions of these states. The rules, because deer were in low numbers, the rules or they were introduced originally for hunting, the rules are around game management, which actually helped the deer to spread. They prevented measures which were going to be more effective controlling, most even preventing spotlighting at night. So the deer numbers are rapidly growing. And, well, yeah, the example we talked about is in New South Wales, where the landowners who are now seeing them on their property, they're having to, late at night, night after night, have to shoot the deer, but they keep coming back because the neighbours around them aren't doing their bit. There's no coordinated control program. There's no baiting available. So they're just seeing hundreds of deer keep coming to their property, taking away their grazing lands. One deer farmer said it's costing them $40,000 a year in lost production. They're eating crops, they're breaking fences, and they're causing major environmental damage.
So we know that they're not going to exterminate all the deer, the feral deer.
Yeah.
So it's obviously it's an issue of management. Who's responsible for that?
Well, you know, who's responsible? It's a state government responsibility, but it's also a landowner responsibility. But, you know, the landowners, they haven't got deer now, are going to get deer ultimately because the modelling shows they will probably cover most of Australia. We've got six deer species in Australia, one in Tasmania, the fallow deer, four in Victoria, six in New South Wales. So their ranges are going to expand. And really, we need a containment strategy. We need a strategy to stop their spread. So the places where the deer are, it's going to be pretty much impossible unless it's small isolated population to eradicate those. But if we can contain them, we need a major research investment so that we can make new tools available for, you know, landowners who want to control them. And the other element is we need to shift from game management thinking to pest management. Victoria, New South Wales and Tasmania are the last states to declare deer as pest. Look, the hunters are going to have deer for centuries ahead to hunt, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't acknowledge they're causing a major impact across the board. Even car accidents around the Illawarra area, over 9 people were killed in a 7-year period from deer near the highways. So it's a safety issue as well. We need to acknowledge that they're a problem and we need to do something about them to rein their spread in.
And your job is to look out for these new invasive species.
Yeah, it's the new emerging ones that I think people don't want to do anything about them until basically if they spread to, you know, to cover, you know, they're in their backyards and yeah. By then it's too late. So we're saying, look, act early, a stitch in time saves 9. And that's why this Protect Australia campaign we've just launched this week, which is calling for a bolstering of biosecurity in Australia to stop the things arriving in the first place. It's going to mean big wins and we're not going to have new pests taking over Australia. We've already got enough problems as we already got. Let's make sure we don't get a new type of cane toad, another type of feral cat, another disease. We've already got diseases that impact on our eucalypts. Make sure we don't get one that's going to impact on our wattles, for example. There's lots of threats on our doorstep. We've got to keep them out.
Andrew Cox, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Tony.
CEO of the Invasive Species Council, Andrew Cox, and their campaign to overhaul biosecurity in Australia. It's called Protect Australia. You can find out more information on the Invasive Species Council website. Well, despite being hailed as a game changer for rabbit management, the rollout of the K5 Khaleesi virus has received mixed reports. In southeast New South Wales, farmers were initially disappointed but are now starting to see some noticeable results. A reporter, Josh Becker, caught up with one farmer who's trying everything to get rid of rabbits on his farm.
You haven't seen a rabbit because of the time of day, but you know, these are the sort of warrens that goes over there, down to there, over there. It's a sort of huge area of warren. It's probably all interconnected. I'm Derek Lewis and I'm on a property we've just started to try and improve. Only just purchased it in Rocky Hall. It's a property with a sort of historical rabbit problem and a lot of big warrens.
It's quite a picturesque view. We're at the top of a hill here and as we can see there's a few warrens already, one behind us, and you think there's a few more in front of us here?
Yeah, look, if you go starting to walk through the Powhatusik there, you'll find warrens everywhere in amongst all the scrubby bits. That's one of the issues we have, of course, is, you know, while we're meant to be sort of looking after the native vegetation, we're also trying to manage rabbits and things like that. It's quite a balancing act.
And you were one of the first places to roll out that K5 virus, as it was meant to have a big impact on rabbits. At the start, it didn't look good. How are things tracking now? What, 6 months on, 8 months on?
Yeah, we'd sort of almost given it up as a lost cause, because we had a fair few rabbits, Barragut, Rocky Hall. Anyway, we let it go and saw really no significant change, or no dead rabbits, which I think is the way you'd measure it. Just recently, we've had, in all the valley, everyone's reporting an increase in rabbit population, and we've also started seeing quite a lot of dead rabbits, like nothing to find, sort of 10 or 12 new dead rabbits every day, just sort of walking around a paddock.
So why do you think that is?
Well, we hope that it's that Khaleesi. They certainly look like they're not Mixo or anything else, so they look good, healthy, fat rabbits.
But that increase in rabbits, that's not a good sign, though, is it?
No, the rabbits to us are an enormous problem. I mean, we've got this background history of serrated tussock in the area. If you've got a rabbit digging a hole, he makes the ideal conditions for a serrated tussock to come up. Plus, the sheer numbers of them, they're actually a very significant pasture remover, and they take the best bits. You know, little short clovers, they really hammer. And clover's the sort of the engine of our whole grass industry, really.
What have you found as the best way to tackle rabbits in this particular part of the world?
Well, our experience was, and this goes back 20 years, that to actually remove all the warrens is the critical bit. And we had a program with our Landcare group, which was very effective, where we ripped any warrens we could with tractors, and we also got the ones in rocks blown up with an explosive person. Unfortunately, Osama bin Laden ruined that for us, and we're now no longer allowed to play with that sort of useful tool. But anyway.
Really? Is that it?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It became much harder to get an explosives license.
Right, okay.
And certainly people who go and buy ammonium nitrate at the agriculture store are now far more worried.
Do you think that you've got on top of things here? Do you think that you've had success with the rabbit issue?
So in the area that has been done well, yes, but this new block, we might be 10% of the way, and it's big dollars. We had an excavator for 2 days and might have done a quarter of the property, and you've got to follow that up. If there's any of those warrens open, you have to do it. So we're trying to do from the worst area outwards and try and get everything. But I believe other people in the district have managed that.
You think the K5 virus is starting to work, but you've also seen an increase. Do you think that part of that could be down to the dry conditions that we're seeing across the southeast?
Yeah, as I understand it, rabbits love dry conditions. They pick up all sorts of diseases when they're getting wet running around. So the shorter the grass, the better. And like a sheep can manage where a cow can't, well, a rabbit can manage where a sheep can't, and they actually do well on it.
So what's next for you here? How long do you think it'll take to get on top of the issue on your new property here?
Well, I'd like to think we'd have it all done in a year, but that's probably totally unrealistic. I have about 17 years' worth of stuff that needs to be done. And priority one at the moment, serrated tussock. We've got to get it all before it seeds. This is the critical time of the year. You have these things you have to do. You've got to look after your animals. You've got to look after your serrated tussock. It's so wonderful in this world where we're so meant to manage our biosecurity. And I think the people who designed this new scheme were all boffins in offices who need to measure what we do. Well, we know what we're doing. We're doing the basic stuff. We have to keep doing that. And, maybe we'll have time to write it all down. I don't know.
That's Derek Lewis, beef and sheep producer on his farm at Rocky Hall, speaking there to our reporter Josh Becker about the rollout of the K5 Khaleesi virus, a game changer for rabbit management. 24 minutes past midday on the Country Hour on ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania. Coming up later in the program, we'll get an update from the Tasmanian government on the help to repair flood-damaged properties. Flood damage from June 2016. Still repairs going on at properties across the state. We'll talk about that. But in just a moment, a decision on whether or not to allow telecom companies to roam onto Telstra networks to try and improve the NBN. That story coming up shortly.
Hello. Rick Goddard here. You know how much I love a good run. Well, it's now easier to take me with you on your run with the new ABC Listen app. In fact, I'm so totally on board with this app that I just can't stop talking about it.
Woohoo! Let me catch my breath.
It's chock full of the ABC's live radio streams and podcasts. Plus, you can follow your favourite programs, like mine, to make it suit your own totally amazing style. Now there's no excuse not to run with me. Hey, I'll race you to the end.
You're with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart
and across Tasmania.
And the mobile phone black spots will not be solved by allowing telecom companies to roam onto Telstra networks. That's the final ruling by the competition regulator. The ACCC says roaming would deter investments by Telstra and also Optus in improving coverage. Serena Locke has the story.
Rod Sims, chairman of the ACCC, has made the ruling.
We felt that declaring roaming would not improve coverage for people in regional areas. It could actually risk the level of coverage. And secondly, we felt it could mean higher prices in regional areas as well.
You're standing on a hill, your car bonnet, or at the bottom of your drive to get a good mobile phone signal. Everyone in the country knows what a black spot is. Everybody loves to curse Telstra. But the ACCC says allowing competitors like Vodafone to roam their mobile connections across to Telstra networks would not solve the problem. Vodafone says the ACCC has failed to intervene in a market where Telstra is clearly dominant with 84% of the regional phone market and where Telstra has received $2 billion in mobile black spot funding. But Rod Sims has defended the ACCC's decision.
Well, it's a monopoly they have built. And there is a big difference in that.
Rather than a government regulation monopoly?
That's right. And Optus are investing to challenge them and doing that reasonably successfully with new technology. For example, Optus is now using satellites and small cell technology to put Optus mobile roaming capability into roadhouses in remote areas. That's just one form of investment we're worried about not happening. We're also worried that if you've got roaming, what's the incentive for Telstra to improve its coverage into new areas? At the moment, Telstra does that to give it an advantage. If everybody has access to Telstra's network, what's the incentive on Telstra to have that investment? More importantly, perhaps, we would have to set a price for that access. The concern we had is that that extra access price would be passed on to regional consumers and they would then start paying more than they're paying now under the national pricing model that all the mobile players use at the moment. So we had worried about would people in regional areas get less coverage and would they face higher prices.
But you have responded to Vodafone's calls for greater transparency of how the networks are set up and the network quality. So what are you asking in terms of improvements for regional coverage of mobile phones?
We're doing a couple of things. The main one, well, two things. One is to get greater awareness and transparency of what coverage is provided by each of the operators and what investment they're doing so that business and residential consumers will know what they can get, where at the moment they don't have full knowledge of that. And perhaps as important, if not more important, the policymakers know where to target the Black Spots program and other programs so that we can improve coverage. That information is not there at the moment. We want to make sure that when companies say they're doing something and say you can get something, that's actually the case, that what they say actually gets translated on the ground, and that will give them greater impetus to do more. Secondly, we want to improve the way facilities are shared. You have these mobile towers in regional areas. We want to improve the extent to which people can share them so that each of the mobile providers can provide coverage from those towers, make that more likely.
So sharing the towers, but not roaming across the networks.
Look, that's right. We want to give companies an incentive to invest. That's the key issue here. Telstra has got a bigger network than other players. It judges that that's an advantage for Telstra to have that better network. It invests to keep that network. We know it's investing in response to what the investment Optus is doing, and we just wouldn't want to see that stop.
It's failed to satisfy Vodafone, really. They've already responded quite quickly to your decision not to allow roaming. They say roaming works in other countries, in New Zealand and much of Europe. Why couldn't it work here?
I think there's selective examples used all the time in this debate. You can give examples where there is roaming, and you can give examples where authorities have decided against roaming. The main time roaming is used is where you've got regional monopolies. So Company A has a monopoly in a particular area and Company B has a monopoly in another area, and authorities there have mandated sharing because you've got one company sharing with another company and they still have some incentive to invest because they're getting a reciprocal benefit. Where you've got the situation we've got here, roaming is less likely overseas, and indeed some countries have now moved away from roaming, judging that it has damaged the incentive to invest. So I think this is selective quoting of the overseas experience. Like most things with statistics, you can drag them up to prove your case, but there's roaming examples and there's roaming examples that can prove very different things.
It's not the only report the ACCC is working on to do with the communications market, and it's still taking submissions on how communications can be more efficient and effective in regional areas.
Serena Locke with that report, and we also heard from Rod Sims from the ACCC, who says the mobile phone black spot problem will not be solved by allowing telecom companies to roam onto Telstra networks. And there'll be a special investigation, a special report on the NBN in tonight's edition of Four Corners on ABC TV. Don't miss that. Dave Matthews joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Dave.
Hi, how's it going?
Yeah, pretty good. Rainfall, did we have much?
It was mainly in the west of the state to 9 a.m. this morning. Mount Reid, 2.4 mils, Sean and Strawn had 2 mils each. So the high totals into the west. And since 9 a.m. this morning, we've had 1 mil at Mount Sakura Island, and Strawn's just had a little bit as well. So not too much at the moment. Most of the rainfall on radar is actually south of the state, just passing over the waters just south of our southern coast. So that's where most of the activity is at the moment.
Okay. And the big focus this week, obviously, the Hobart show on later in the week. What's the outlook telling us?
Yeah, so the outlook at the moment, we've got for tomorrow, ridge will weaken over the state and a trough will develop just to the north there. So showers basically clearing about the northwest and southeast in the afternoon and evening, and light winds with afternoon local sea breezes. A little bit of rainfall into the east of the state tomorrow, looking at maybe around 7 to 10 mils or so into the northeast area, so you know, between St. Mary's, Bishano area seems to be the focal point at the moment. So hopefully there'll be a little bit of rain into there for tomorrow. And then on Wednesday we've got a ridge moving over the state, and that trough will weaken as a low passes to the north across the mainland, so showers contracting to the west and south during the evening with northwesterly winds. And then show day, we've got a ridge over the state, it's we've got light winds as well, with showers about the west and south. They'll contract to the southwest coast during the afternoon. So west-southwesterly winds. So I think for Hobart, probably looking at probably partly cloudy or cloudy day. There'll be a bit of cloud around, and there might be one or two light showers around. Probably more likely, I'd say, in the afternoon into the evening. So it should be, a fairly good day to go to the show, and the forecast max temp of 18.
Okay. Any warnings, Dave?
No warnings for today or tomorrow.
All right. And the coastal waters and the swell, what's happening there?
Yeah, so today we've got northwest to southwesterly winds, 10 to 20 knots, becoming light and variable. About the east in the afternoon, afternoon coastal sea breezes, seas will be 1 to 2 metres. With the swell in the west and south, we've got west to southwesterly 2 to 2.5 metres. In the north, westerly around 1 metre. And in the east, southerly 1 to 2 metres, and that will be decreasing throughout the day. And tomorrow, west south southwest winds, 10 to 15 knots. They'll be around 15 to 20 knots in the southeast and in the north, with afternoon sea breezes occurring mainly in the east coast and southeast coasts. Seas will be 1 to 2 metres, and the swells are west and south, the southwesterly around 1 to 2 metres, in the north, westerly about half a metre, and in the east, southerly around 1 metre, rising to 1.5 in the south.
Okay, Dave, nothing else for us?
No, I think that covers everything, I think.
Beauty. Thank you for that.
All right, thank you.
See you later. Dave Matthews from the Bureau with the latest information for you on the Country Hour on ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania. Still to come on the program, we'll talk about workplace safety and a new app launched, and hopefully that app will find its way to many farms across the state. Also, the Primary Industries Minister, Jeremy Rockliffe, will update us on the flood recovery, which is still going on many, many months, 18 months almost, or 15 months after the June 2016 floods in Tasmania. A warning on vegetable prices, lots and lots of rain in southern Queensland, and some of the vegetables that we get from those areas possibly will be more expensive and could be very rare in the coming weeks. We'll talk about that as well. And we'll take you to a special place on a special island on Flinders Island coming up later in the program as well.
The ABC Classic Flow Podcast. Blissful yoga and meditation set to classical music. Pranayama, yin, restorative, and desk yoga, all guided by teacher Lara Zilabovitz. Classic Flow features music by the Classic Flow String Quartet and the Australian Voices. Give your body what it craves. Find Classic Flow wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe
on ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania.
And yet another app, and this one for workplace safety. The state government has recruited an app in its campaign to make Tasmanian workplaces healthier and safer. Today, the Minister for Resources, Building and Construction, Guy Barnett, launched the digital strategy, part of their Healthy Tasmanian Workplace initiative.
The initiative is to encourage people to live more healthy, active lifestyles, specifically in the workplace. It's a Ritualise app. You can download it from the WorkSafe website. We encourage everybody to do that. From November 20, it'll be free for those businesses in Tasmania. So we're backing it. We want people in their workplaces to be more healthy, more active, and of course that's the bulk of your time, really. It's more than a third of your time, and it happens in the workplace. So we're very keen to promote it. It's part of our consistent with the being the healthiest state by 2025. And I have type 1 diabetes and Diabetes Australia Ambassador, so I'm very committed to help promoting this particular initiative.
So how does an app drive healthy choices?
Well, basically it gives you prompts. It sort of helps you in terms of monitoring what you're doing, when you're doing it, and encourages you to be physically active, encourages you to drink lots of water, encourages you to get a good sleep. It encourages offers other opportunities in terms of recommendations to live healthy, active lifestyles, specifically in the workplace.
Now, we know a lot about the statistics of health and obesity Australia-wide, but as the Minister responsible for WorkSafe Tasmania, can you just give us a sense of what has to be achieved yet in terms of making it a healthier and safer workplace?
Yes, well, first of all, we've come a long way. We've had some improvements the last 6 years in terms of our workplace injuries. They've gone down by over 25%, so we've seen some good action, but there's a lot more work to do. We're amongst the fattest, more obese. Smoking is a serious issue, so Michael Ferguson's leading the charge there, but in the workplace, and with respect to workplace behaviour, we can make a difference. So the Ritualise app is, for example, changing people's behaviour to encourage better behaviour in terms of what we eat and in terms of our exercise regime.
Now, a lot of farmers aren't formal workplaces as when we think of sort of industry and manufacturing, but they are workplaces. What are your ambitions for making farming safer?
Well, in terms of safe farming, of course, as a government, we are backing it to the hilt. We're working with the key stakeholders, TFGA and primary employers and many others, women in agriculture, to encourage safe farm handling and safe farming. Phil John, for example, he's our man on the ground, and farmers and their families and those in the workplace can contact him. We're backing it with $1 million over the next 4 years to promote safe farming.
Do you get a sense that the health issues you've talked about, diabetes, obesity, play just as a bigger role in farming?
Yes, it does. It does play a big role in farming. In the rural and regional areas, it is important. Sometimes we can forget about the importance of that. Of course, you're a little bit more active in the workplace, in a farm. I was born and raised on a farm, so of course, know about that. But we can still do a lot more in terms of our nutrition and in terms of developing good habits.
And you think this app is available to farmers and farming businesses?
Yes, the app is available from the 20th of November. Just register on the WorkSafe website, put in your details, and the app will be made available to you for free, which is really good. And as a government, we're backing it because we wanted a practical initiative to change people's habits in the workplace.
Resources, Building and Construction Minister Guy Barnett at the Work Health, Safety and Wellbeing Expo, which is being held at Princess Wharf today and tomorrow at Salamanca, launching that new app to help keep you safe in the workplace. And if you want more information about that, the best place to go is the worksafe.tas.gov website. 17 minutes to one on the Country Hour. We'll talk about flooding in the north and the extent still of flood damage in Tasmania in just a moment.
Hello, this is Chris Arnold, Chief Officer with the Tasmania Fire Service. A properly prepared home is more likely to survive a bushfire than one that hasn't been prepared. And the chances increase significantly if able-bodied people are there to protect the home. Are you prepared for this bushfire season? Download the Prepare Act Survive booklet from fire.tas.gov.au. Stay aware and stay tuned to
ABC Radio Hobart, your emergency broadcaster.
This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe.
It's now 16 minutes to one. Don't forget you can get details of our stories online at abc.net.au/rural. And feel free to visit our Tasmanian Country Hour Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter as well. The handle at Tas Country Hour, the hour spelt HR. Well, more than 180 landowners in Tasmania have now been helped with funding to repair properties after the June floods of last year. Well, another 230 landowners have received technical advice to assist them with flood damage. Primary Industries Minister Jeremy Rockliffe today outlined details of the government assistance so far at the Mitchelson's property in the Meander Valley, which suffered serious damage from floodwaters.
We're on their fifth generation property that, like many properties across Tasmania, were devastated by the June 2016 floods. Has 7 kilometres of river frontage, and we've got the Meander River, and the agricultural landscape rehabilitation scheme was announced after the floods, a $4 million scheme. We provided additional funds of $2 million in the May budget this year to support some 180 landholders, some 230 landholders in actual fact have had technical advice as a result of the devastating floods, which of course were across 24 catchments and 20 local government areas. And since that time, can I commend the three regions, the natural resource management regions, who have done a wonderful job in working with landholders, and the NRMs are represented here today. We've had people on the ground providing technical advice, project facilitation advice for farmers and landholders who literally were devastated by the largest flood in living memory. As I say, the Mitchelsons have been here since 1887? I read on your shirt. And I think the last biggest flood was about 1929, but this is the biggest flood in living memory and caused untold damage to the Tasmanian community. At least $180 million of infrastructure damage across Tasmania, but for particular farmers and property owners, it had a massive impact in terms of farmers' cash flow. Livestock were lost, fence was lost, sheds, irrigators, and significant damage to landscape and to property. And the rehabilitation scheme has been utilised by families such as the Mitchelsons to, as you can see, ensure that not only is the landscape rehabilitated to productive land that can go on earning income and employ people in the local community, but also do what we can to prevent such damage again occurring if another flood, and let's hope it doesn't, comes along in the near to long term future. 5 kilometres of the 7 kilometres of this property, for example, has been or in the process of being rehabilitated. Willow removal, gorse removal, bank stabilisation.
Primary Industries Minister Jeremy Rockliffe on assistance to farmers still repairing properties after last year's terrible floods in Tasmania, talking there to ABC News. Well, to the north now, and the price of some vegetables is already increasing after torrential rain and flooding caused millions of dollars of damage to crops around Queensland. The flood ravaged Wide Bay Burnett region produces around 85% of Australia's sweet potatoes and is also one of the nation's largest suppliers of chilies, capsicums and cucumbers. The wholesale price of sweet potatoes in Queensland has already risen some 400% in 6 days. Consumers are being warned that many vegetables could be in short supply until at least Christmas. On the Sunshine Coast, lettuce is in shorter supply. Growers who were praying for rain 2 weeks ago are now counting the costs of the flooding.
At Pomona, the frogs are singing and Terry Wakeham's dam is full. But her Jet Fresh hydroponic lettuce farm has taken a bit of a hit. Thousands of dollars worth of crop had to be thrown out because of the rain.
Certainly it has had impact on the roadways and so forth. And our product too, we've had to throw away a couple of hydroponic tables. It just turns the lettuce to, you know, soggy mush. But we will see more impact in the coming couple of days. The lettuce is just sitting there and it struggles and the tips get burnt with the sun coming out. But on the other side, the upside, is our dams are full. We feel really sorry for people who ground grow because, of course, they've lost all their soil. But because we're a hydroponic situation, it's more just the residual problems that we have moving forward over the next week.
What sort of crop losses have you had?
Probably a couple of $1,000, I would say. But, you know, that's life on the farm. And after 9 years, you become a little bit more fatalistic about these sorts of things. That's life.
How much lettuce do you produce here?
We probably produce about 30,000 a week. 700 kilos a week.
2 weeks ago, how desperate was the situation with the dry?
Well, it was getting to that point. We measured the dam and it was getting a little low. We've probably got about 2 years supply in our dam. So, but, you know, any rain is grateful. We just wish that it would stop once the dams got full. I think everyone was feeling the same way. We got over, well and truly over 300 mil here in Pomona since Friday.
Tina from the produce wholesaler was telling me that a lot of the lettuce can get quite slimy after rain.
Oh, definitely. And so we always have to clean the bases and that of any heads that we sell. But certainly what goes into our bags, we have a saying in our processing room, if you don't want to see it on your plate, then chuck it out. So the ladies are very vigilant and make sure that what we sell is the best quality that we can produce.
This is Alwyn Weir. He's just got back from the Rocklea markets and hopefully we can get a bit of a situation report on how things have been going.
Oh, well, there's a really, really shortage of quality produce. They can't get on the grounds to dig. It's affecting all North Queensland supply because that's where 90% of the stuff's coming from at this stage. So it's in a bit of a pickle at the minute. They've even had problems around here. They had a hailstorm out where the avocados are growing just out at North Arm the other day and knocked all the flowers off. So there'll be no avocados from that farm for, you know, people won't see that hit until when they're ready to pick their avocados after Christmas.
We've seen some of those pictures of millions of dollars worth of crop losses around Bundaberg. You've got tomato fields underwater.
Yeah, well, it's not only tomatoes, capsicums, corn, beans, all that sort of stuff's coming from up there now. Cherry tomatoes, yeah. Sweet potatoes is the main thing. They've went up 400% in the last 6 days.
Wow.
Yeah, they went from around the $20 a box to today they were $80 a box.
What sort of other price rises are you seeing?
Lettuce went up today. Lettuce, cauliflowers, broccoli, tomatoes, cherry tomatoes, capsicums, all that sort of stuff. Corn, it all went up immensely today, yeah. Some lines double, some lines triple.
Al, how long have you been doing this for?
42 years.
What can we expect in terms of how long it's going to take for things to get back to normal?
Well, it's not only the immediate effect of it now because they can't harvest. Now they can't plant for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, so that in 3 months' time there's going to be a shortage again because they can't get on their grounds to plant.
So people can expect to be paying more for veg, basically, for the foreseeable future?
Oh, right up to Christmas, probably. I'd say yes, yeah, for sure.
How important do you think it is for consumers to be a little bit understanding at the moment if everything isn't perfect?
Well, they've just got to understand we've just gone through the best winter we've had for a few years because we've had no rain and the produce was fantastic. And now we're going to cop a little bit of a hiding and then it'll come good again and then we'll get another hiding, but that's the nature of fruit and vegetables. We can't control the weather. Some districts get hit harder than others and that's the nature of it. If you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, you lose your crop and then the prices go up and the people that got the crop, well, they benefit because they get the higher prices and sometimes vice versa, you know.
Alwyn Weir, a fruit and vegetable buyer with 42 years' experience, ending that report on damage to vegetables from heavy rain in southern Queensland, especially things like sweet potatoes, avocados, tomatoes, chilies and capsicums. Price increases on the agenda and maybe shortages. In a moment, we'll take you back to Flinders Island.
Hello. Rick Goddard here. You know how much I love a good run. Well, it's now easier to take me with you on your run with the new ABC Listen app. In fact, I'm so totally on board with this app that I just can't stop talking about it.
Woohoo! Let me catch my breath.
It's chock full of the ABC's live radio streams and podcasts. Plus, you can follow your favourite programs, like mine, to make it suit your own totally amazing style. Now there's no excuse not to run with me. Hey, I'll race you to the end.
This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe.
And Wendy Jubstoney knows isolation. She has two homes and both are isolated. One house is in the Hauqua Valley in Victoria's High Country. The other is at Badger's Corner on Flinders Island. Wendy grew up on Flinders and Long Island, and next year she's opening up a cooking school called Flinders Island Gourmet Retreat at Badger's Corner, which is situated between White Mark and Lady Barron in southern Flinders. It combines her love of food with her love of her two homes on Flinders Island and also in the High Country.
We're on the south fall of Mount Buller in the Hauqua Hills on a property called Stockyard Creek. And it's extraordinarily picturesque up there. A lot of films have been made there as well because of its beauty.
And remoteness?
Well, my husband and I are the only ones who live in the Hauqua Valley, although there are a lot of people who visit and they camp there, but we are actually the only ones who live there full time. And yes, it's remote. You can't just run out of milk and say, oh, I'll go down to the shop. We're 45 minutes away from Mansfield along a mountain road that's quite winding and gravel and difficult sometimes if there's snow or too much rain or not enough rain with too much dust.
Wendy, we're sitting by your big broad bench. We're having a homemade lemon cordial and we're looking out over what on Flinders Island?
We're looking out over Petrification Bay. We're looking north up to towards Babel Island and in the foreground you can see all those Echiums and Watsonias.
So we're on the southern tip of Flinders Island, but just in terms of the remoteness, you've talked about Hauqua River and its remoteness. How does the remoteness of Flinders Island compare?
Well, it really doesn't because I've got neighbours here. I'm only 20 minutes away from White Mark or 10 minutes away from Lady Barron, and I'm only an hour away from Melbourne by plane, whereas if I drive from Hauqua Hills to Melbourne, it's 3.5 hours.
So what brings you to these remote places?
I grew up here on Flinders Island and on Long Island, which is one of the little islands just off Cape Barron Island. And so I have a great love of this place especially. But I know how to live, I suppose, in remote areas.
You've launching a cooking school and guest house. Why cooking and why a school?
Well, I suppose my great passion has always been cooking good food from scratch, and that's why I have my own gardens as well. I went to Hauquadale Gourmet Retreat, which is a place out of Mansfield, It operated for 20-odd years or more. It's no longer open, but there I learned to cook with some of the best chefs in Australia. And so that business model really appealed to me, and I asked the two women, Sarah and Marika, if they minded if I copied it or replicated it. And so that's what I'm attempting to do down here on Flinders Island, have a cooking school inviting people to utilise the best produce that Tasmania probably has got anyway. I'll be a bit parochial.
We are seeing a few cooking schools, but 20 years ago, that was quite a visionary thing then, surely, for Hakoda.
Yes, it was. In fact, it's probably been closed since about 2002, but they were operating for at least 20 years prior to that, prior to them closing. And yeah, they were visionary. They are visionary women. And so, yeah, why wouldn't I want to take a leaf out of their book?
But Flinders is a unique story. What's the story that you'll tell with your cooking school?
Well, the uniqueness of the produce here is one of the points of differentiation. Not many people can get wallaby, for example, and I am very well known for my wallaby ragu. I also utilise a lot of the plants that are around the seashore, and you can't readily get those. I mean, you can buy some Snowy River Mountain, what's it called? Snowy River Company. They sell, Andrew French sells in Sydney and places like that. So he's developed all of these beautiful sea vegetables, if you like, but I just go around here and gather these. I haven't actually grown them. The sea, nature has done that for me. So the other points of differentiation that I want to show here are that you can actually have restfulness if it's a day like today. You can still have restfulness when the wind is blowing, because it can blow cities full of clouds away and you will feel at peace. You know, it's just such a special place. The other thing about Flinders Island is that it's one of the first settlements south of Sydney. In fact, it is the first settlement south of Sydney. The sealers came down here. The other thing is that we've got an Aboriginal and European connection that is really strong here on Flinders Island, where people have worked together for a long time.
Given you have this base at Mansfield in the high country of Victoria, you've got this base here in Flinders, what's your identity? Do you have one, or do you think your heart's in both places a little?
Well, it's like this. I think that love is something that is not just a small cake that you have to cut in half or into slices. Love actually grows. And so I have a heart that just keeps growing. And I share that with a lot of people. And I do have people that want to experience things in the high country, and I do have people who want to experience things down here on Flinders Island.
Wendy Jubstoney from Flinders Island talking there to Sally Dacus, ending the Country Hour for today. Details of our stories online. That's the program. We'll catch you after midday tomorrow.